And I'm back to read to you Hitler's War by David Irving. A bitter victory. Hitler had fully taken into account the susceptibilities of his new allies. In a directive issued at the beginning of April 1941, he stated that he himself would assign the necessary campaign objectives for the Italian and Hungarian forces. Horthy was no problem, but the Duce, his amour propre, injured by a succession of defeats, obliged Hitler to adopt public postures and contortions on Italy's behalf that for once united the OKW, the foreign ministry, the army, and the navy in a seething, uncomprehending anger at their Führer's indulgence of his inept ally. Within 12 days of Hitler's attack, Yugoslavia was defeated. The British Expeditionary Force found itself fighting a hopeless rearguard action against the German Armored and Mountain Corps, which had comfortably sidestepped the formidable Metaxas line to pour into Yugoslavia and Greece. The British had committed a real blunder in purchasing the coup d'etat in Belgrade. Hitler had ordered the attack to begin with the saturation bombing of Belgrade, with an eye to the deterrent effect on other powers, notably Turkey and the Soviet Union. As many as 17,000 civilians were killed in the air raid. Robbed of their nerve center, the Yugoslav armies caved in. Over 340,000 Yugoslav soldiers were taken prisoner. The Germans lost only 151 dead, although they bore the brunt of the fighting. Oh, man. Throughout the campaign, the Italians and the Hungarians displayed a marked reluctance to attack until the enemy had first been soundly beaten by the German troops. Horthy expressed the pious hope that in the coming fighting the Hungarian armies would not be led too far astray from Hungary. At that time, he had no knowledge of Hitler's plans to launch a coalition war against Russia within 3 months. On the afternoon of April 19th, German radio broadcast the first string of 6 special bulletins on the victories in the southeast. Huell noted the magnificent mood at Hitler's chancellery. The mood was dimmed briefly when 50 British bombers arrived over Berlin. Hitler took refuge in his air raid shelter and, after the raid was over, sent Huell to tour the blitzed area. Bellevue Castle, the Crown Prince's Palace, the State Library, and the University had been badly damaged. In the State Opera House, Unter den Linden, the fires were out of control. Churchill claimed he had killed 3,000 in Berlin, wanting to play off the casualties in Berlin against those in Belgrade. Goebbels suppressed the real figure, just 15. In revenge, a week later, Hitler sent the Luftwaffe to raid London continuously for 10 hours with 1,000 tons of bombs. Late on April 10th, his train left Berlin for Munich, and on the 11th he continued through Vienna toward Graz. Here a tunnel took the single-track railway through the Alps. The OKW command train Atlas halted on the far side of the ice-cold 3,000-yard-long tunnel. Hitler's America stopped before entering it, near the little station of Munichkirchen. This heavily guarded area was to be his headquarters for the next 2 weeks. His only contacts with the outside world were the OKW's communications system, the showing of rough-cut newsreels at nearby Munichkirchener Hof Hotel, and the visits of his generals and ministers. On April 12th, the Nazi banner was already flying over the ruins of Belgrade. On the 14th, the Greeks began evacuating Albania. On the 15th, the OKW learned that the British Expeditionary Force was in full flight towards its ports of embarkation. Broadcasting to the Yugoslav nation, Churchill offered deceptive comfort. The British were still standing right behind them, an unfortunately ambiguous statement, which Goebbels instructed his press media to exploit to the full. Hitler's instructions to the OKW were that if Greece surrendered, all Greek prisoners were to be released, as a mark of his admiration for the valor with which they had defended their frontiers. Hitler laid down the principle that surrender offers were always to be accepted by German commanders, however small the enemy unit involved. Field Marshal List formally accepted the Greek army's surrender on April 21st, even though the Greek commander, General Sulakoglu, made it plain that he was not surrendering to the Italians, whom his forces had soundly defeated, and indeed had not seen for some days. Mussolini was livid. Italy, blustered the Duce, had been fighting with 500,000 men and lost 63,000 dead in her 6 months of war with Greece. Then suddenly the SS lifeguards had advanced so far that they held a bridge which actively blocked the Italian pursuit of the Greeks. Hitler reluctantly backtracked and told Jodl that List was wrong to have accepted the surrender and that the fight must go until the Greeks surrendered to the Italians too. Ribbentrop visited Hitler that afternoon, April 21st. Hill noted, "Surrender talks are in progress with the Greek army. Obstacle, the Italians. Everybody is furious, even the Führer. He is always torn between soldier and politician." Not only had the Greek army surrendered to the Germans and laid down its arms, but the greater part of it was already in captivity. How were the Greeks now to continue fighting for Italy's benefit? Hitler sent word to the Duce's headquarters that perhaps the Italians would like to send a representative to assist Jodl in settling the surrender terms with the Greeks the next morning, April 22nd. Mussolini's forces had, however, opened a bedraggled offensive on the Epirus front as soon as word of the Greek surrender to List reached him. The Greeks were not only still fighting there, they were inflicting heavy casualties on the Italians. God, the Italians are just incompetent, aren't they? The OKW rushed a draft of the surrender terms to Rome. When Mussolini read in the draft that the Führer wanted to allow the Greek officers to retain their swords and daggers, he protested. Here, however, the Germans were adamant. The whole world had marveled at the Greek army's prolonged resistance, and Hitler considered it proper to recognize their bravery. That apart, Hitler blindly accepted the Italian demands. To the fury of Admiral Raeder, he announced that the Yugoslav and Greek navies were to be handed over to the Italians when they arrived. To the fury of both the OKW and the army, Hitler also bowed to Mussolini's demand that the Axis troops stage a ceremonial entry into Athens, with Italians and Germans side by side. The nearest Italians were still a week's march away from Athens, which did not make things easier. At Salonika, the surrender document was signed by all three parties on the afternoon of April 23rd, after Mussolini had played his final trick on Hitler. The Führer had forbidden premature release of the surrender news, but at 10 a.m. the Italians had already suddenly broadcast it to the world. "The enemy armies of Epirus and Macedonia have laid down their arms. The surrender was tendered by a Greek military delegation yesterday at 9:04 p.m. to the commander of the Italian 11th Army on the Epirus front." Hill summed it up in his diary. "The Italians are acting like crazy idiots." In Croatia, a breakaway movement had been fomented by Canaris's underground forces. General Slatko Kvaternik, an officer of the old Austro-Hungarian army, had seized power in Zagreb, aided by the Abwehr's Jupiter organization. And with Hitler's blessing, he had set up an independent state with Dr. Ante Pavlik, who had spent long years exiled in Italy as its poglavnik, or chief. Hitler's decision to transfer the Dalmatian coastal region to Italy caused intense resentment in the Zagreb. However, the Führer closed his eyes to the hatred Germany would reap from the Croats by this action. On April 24th, Canaris's Lieutenant Colonel Lehosen interviewed General Kvaternik, the new Croat War Minister in Zagreb. Lehosen found that this ancient upright nationalist admiration for Germany and her Führer was boundless, but so was his hatred of the Italians, who were now wreaking their revenge on Dalmatia. "The Croats are a people of honor with a long military tradition," complained Kvaternik, "and it is bitter beyond words to be trodden down and humiliated now by an army that has not been able to pin one victory to its colors." Kvaternik feared that this completely irrational political attitude of the Italians would sow the seeds of serious future danger. On April 24, 1941, the Hungarian regent Admiral Horthy visited Hitler's train. Hitler had received from the admiral many letters written in a quaint, archaic German style. The most recent had come in mid-April. In it, Horthy had once more suggested a German attack on Russia and hinted that Hungary would participate if the whole of Transylvania, at present partly under Romanian rule, were promised to him. "Nobody else knows I have written this letter, and I shall never mention it, even in any memoirs I may write." On April 19th, Hitler had acknowledged to the Hungarian envoy Stoje that Horthy obviously felt deeply, as this letter showed, about the Russian menace. He nevertheless inwardly rejected making any commitment to Hungary at Romania's expense. According to Huell's diary, the Hungarian talked and talked during the luncheon, and even argued, using one of Hitler's favorite phrases, that Greece had been defeated because she was a democracy, where the votes of two idiots count for more than that of one wise man. Keitel lured Horthy into plying Hitler with hunting anecdotes, knowing that Hitler abominated huntsmen. Those who knew Hitler were familiar with his loathing of horses. When 3 years later SS General Hermann Fegelein, Himmler's new liaison officer, clanked in wearing riding spurs, Hitler sardonically invited him to gallop next door to fetch a certain document. But nothing could now darken Hitler's mood. The British were in full flight. Hitler had killed or captured another 20,000 elite troops. At Jeschnik's suggestion, Hitler ordered an airborne assault on Crete prepared as well. Hitler's own mind was made up on the Russian campaign, but he still wanted to convince Ribbentrop of its necessity. He knew he would not win over the foreign ministry as such, since its failure to give him advanced warning of the Belgrade putsch, the ministry's stock had sunk still farther in his estimation. He had decided to appoint the party's chief thinker, the Baltic-born Alfred Rosenberg, to manage the new Eastern Dominions, impressed, apparently, by Rosenberg's early writings on the Bolshevik menace. Small wonder that Huell's diary shows Ribbentrop off sick for most of April 1941, malingering, furious at this fresh erosion of his powers. On about April 25th, Hitler telephoned Ribbentrop in Vienna, summoned him to his special train headquarters, and told him he had decided finally to attack Russia. Ribbentrop later recalled, and this is a big quote, he said that all the military intelligence reaching him confirmed that the Soviet Union was preparing in a big way along the entire front from the Baltic to the Black Sea. He was not willing to be taken surprise once he had recognized a danger. Moscow's pact with the Serbian putschist government was a downright provocation to Germany and a clear departure from the German-Russian Treaty of Friendship. In this conversation, I recommended that he listen first to our Moscow ambassador, Count Werner von der Schulenburg. I want to try a diplomatic settlement with Moscow first. But Hitler refused any such attempt and forbade me to discuss the matter with anybody. No amount of diplomacy could change the Russian attitude, as he now recognized it, but it might cheat him of the important tactical element of surprise when he attacked. And that's the end of the quote. On April 26th, Hitler's train left Munich-Kirchen, I think, for the former Yugoslav frontier. He motored to Maribor, namely newly renamed Marburg, and toured the German-speaking provinces which his Second Army had regained for the Reich. Everywhere there was a huge and fervent welcome, especially at Marburg's town hall. Then by train back to Graz, recorded Huell, an enormous reception there. The Führer is very happy. A fanatical welcome. Wonderful singing, the museum, lunch at a hotel at Hotel Wiesler, then left for Klagenfurt in the evening, coffee at the castle, with infinitely ugly maidens provided from the Gauss leadership school, but they could sing very nicely. Here in Klagenfurt, Hitler the next day met his old history teacher, Professor Leopold Poch. He had written in Mein Kampf that it had perhaps altered the whole course of his life that fate gave him such a history teacher, able to bring the subject alive. By April 28th, Adolf Hitler was back in his chancellery in Berlin. in Berlin. That evening, Ribbentrop's ambassador in Moscow was ushered in. Hitler granted to Count Schulenburg just 30 minutes of his time. Schulenburg had not been officially informed of Barbarossa. Hans Krebs, his military attaché, had been forbidden to tell him, but Schulenburg was no simpleton. The rumors sweeping Central Europe told him all he needed. To the ambassador, it seemed that the Führer had drawn all his preconceived ideas from the Vidkun Quisling, who had first whispered to Hitler that after the very first military defeats, the unpopular Bolshevik regime would collapse. Hitler asked him what devil had possessed the Russians that they had signed that pact with the putschist regime in Belgrade. Was it an attempt to frighten Germany? The ambassador's opinion was that the Russians were just openly staking their claim on the Balkans. They were very uneasy about the rumors of a coming German attack as well. Hitler retorted that it was the Russians who had begun the mobilization race, but the ambassador suggested it was characteristic Russian overreaction to German moves. If Stalin had not allied himself with France and Britain when both were still strong and intact, he would hardly opt for them now. To Hitler, this was a facile argument. In 1939, Stalin had wanted to encourage war between Germany and the West. How could he have foreseen that Hitler would emerge victorious so soon? Hitler decided now that Barbarossa would begin on June 22nd, a Sunday, with the onset of the final top-capacity transport program 1 month earlier. The German armies in the south would be numerically inferior to the enemy. Army Group South could not mount the pincer movement originally planned to destroy the Russian forces south of the Pripyat Marshes, but had to attempt an almost impossible encirclement action with its northern wing. Nonetheless, Brauchitsch was still confident that after 4 weeks of stiff fighting on the frontier, the Russian resistance would melt away. Persistent rumors of Barbarossa were soon sweeping Moscow. The most substantial evidence came to Moscow from Romania, and indirectly from Belgrade. Hitler had been most frank in his overtures to General Antonescu. When Goering had seen Antonescu in Vienna on March 5th, he explained that one day the other oil supplier might drop out. Goering had asked how many Romanians now lived on Russian territory, and he had made a scooping gesture by way of explanation. Evidently, Hitler had also told Yugoslavia's Prince Regent about Barbarossa at the Berghof on March 4th. British Foreign Secretary Eden told Sir Stafford Cripps as much. Eden identified his source as King George of Greece, the Prince Regent's brother. The Hungarian intelligence service learned of this in Moscow and passed the information back to Admiral Canaris on April 11th. A few days later, the German naval attaché in Moscow was cabling that Cripps was now predicting that Hitler would attack Russia on June 22nd, a canard so obviously absurd that he would do all he could to kill it. Stalin's reaction to the warnings was illuminating. At Cripps' suggestion, the Yugoslav envoy in Moscow had at the beginning of April warned Stalin about Barbarossa. Stalin had cockily replied, "Let them come. We will be ready for them." Hitler's blitzkrieg victory in the Balkans had wiped the smile off Stalin's face. An extraordinary period ensued in which the Soviet government tried to appease Hitler. Grain, petroleum, manganese, and other materials began flooding westward, and the Soviet government even laid on a special goods train to rush rubber to Germany along the Trans-Siberian Railway. On the day the Japanese foreign minister departed for Tokyo, Stalin made a stunning personal appearance on the railroad platform, embraced the Japanese officials, and then searched out Ambassador Schulenburg and loudly pronounced in front of the assembled diplomatic corps, "We must remain friends. You must do all you can for that." Hitler studied all the reports, including one submitted by the Forschungsamt, on this puzzling Moscow scene. Equally remarkable was the politeness of the Soviet remonstrance over 80 German violations of Soviet airspace in the first half of April. After a conference with Keitel on Abwehr operations planned inside Russia, Admiral Canaris noted, "General Jodl disclosed to me afterward that they are greatly worried about the Russians' soft and indulgent attitude towards us," and added half in jest in a reference to our number 800 special duties. Training Regiment Brandenburg. If these chaps, meaning the Soviet Russians, keep on being so accommodating and taking offense at nothing, then you will have to stage an incident to start the war. And there's an asterisk. The Brandenburg was the German commando regiment. And that's the whole thing. Throughout March, Russian troop movements close to the frontier, had been so intense with a heavy flow of reinforcements from Moscow towards Smolensk and Minsk that General Halder became anxious that the Russians might launch a preventative action. The disposition of Russian forces gives food for thought, he wrote on April 7th. If we discount the slogan that the Russians want peace and won't attack anybody themselves, then it has to be admitted that the Russian dispositions could allow them to go over very rapidly from defense into attack, and this could prove highly embarrassing for us. The Führer himself was in no doubt. At the end of it all, in 1945, he was to say, "I didn't take the decision to attack Moscow lightly, but because I knew from certain information that an alliance was being prepared between Britain and Russia." The big question was, should we hit out first or wait until we were overwhelmed at some time in the future? The naval attaché reported from Moscow that the Soviet naval construction program was in the process of building 3 battleships, 11 cruisers, 61 destroyers, and nearly 300 submarines. Most of this fleet would be concentrated in the Baltic. After April 7th, the German embassy in Moscow observed an increasing tide of conscription. On the 8th, the families of the Russian trade mission began leaving Berlin. On the 23rd, there were fresh reports from Bucharest of Soviet reinforcements massing in Bukovina and Bessarabia. The next day, the German military attaché in Bucharest reported that Soviet troops were arriving at Odessa and being transported by rail to the Bug and Dniester. On the 25th, the naval decoders intercepted a dispatch from the British military attaché in Moscow to the War Office in London. "Our military attaché in Budapest," this read, "who was traveling to Moscow a few days ago, saw at Lemberg, Lov, at least one tank brigade on the railway line between Lemberg and Kiev heading westward. He passed seven troop trains, of which 4 were conveying tanks and mechanized equipment, and 3 troops. The German attachés also saw many military transports heading west between Minsk and Baranovichi. By May 5th, Antonescu was able to tip off the Germans that Soviet troops were massing between Kiev and Odessa, and that reinforcements were still pouring westward from Siberia. The thing worth noting is that the factories around Moscow have been ordered to transfer their equipment into the country's interior." A team of Goering's engineers had been allowed to tour 8 or 9 of the biggest Russian factories producing ball bearings, alloys, aircraft, and aero engines, and to see the advances made by Soviet research. It was clear that the Soviet Air Force was a far greater menace than Hitler had bargained for. The aircraft factories were the biggest and most modern in Europe. When the German experts attended a dinner party, the leading Soviet aircraft designer, Mikoyan, stated explicitly, "We shall valiantly ward off any attack, whatever quarter it comes from." On Red Army orders, foreign diplomats were prevented from traveling freely. On May 13th, the German consul in the heart of China reported that 6 days before Moscow had instructed all missions to ascertain the probable attitude of other countries in the event of a German-Soviet conflict. On the 16th, the Russian envoy in Stockholm was reported to have stated that at no time in Russian history had more powerful troop contingents been massed in the West, which confirmed the estimate of the Swedish air attaché in Moscow, that by mid-March alone, 60% of the Red Army had been massed in Western Russia, particularly confronting Romania. Stalin's trainloads of rubber, ores, oil, and grain kept rolling westward to Hitler's Germany, even as June 22nd, the date for Barbarossa, approached. But the date on which Stalin secretly proposed to resume the Soviet program of expansion, now temporarily halted by Hitler's obduracy, also came closer. On May 5th, Stalin delivered two secret speeches at a Kremlin banquet to 1,000 officers graduating from Moscow's staff colleges. Among the officials who passed through the Kremlin's Trinity Gate that evening were Molotov, Mikoyan, Voroshilov, Kalinin, and Lavrenty Beria. There were also two generals and one major who later fell into German hands and independently described the speeches to German interrogators with a high degree of unanimity. And here's an asterisk right at the bottom of the page. These ominous speeches by Stalin are mentioned in the Russian language memoirs of Marshal Zhukov, but not in the English and German editions. Ullstein, publisher of the original German edition of this Hitler biography, deleted every reference to these speeches. The speeches have since been confirmed by historians working on former Soviet archives. Had Schulenburg, who heard merely that Stalin had delivered a 40-minute speech, been there, perhaps even his optimism about the Soviet Union's designs would have been dispelled. Stalin launched into a sober account of the need to prepare for war with Germany. Big quote. The new tank models, the Mark 1 and 3, are on their way. These are excellent tanks, whose armor can withstand 76mm shells. In the near future, there will also be a new tank graced with my own name. Our war plan is ready. We have built the airfields and landing grounds, and the frontline aircraft are already there. Everything has been done by way of clearing out the rear areas. All the foreign elements have been removed. It follows that over the next 2 months, we can begin the fight with Germany. We have to take our revenge for Bulgaria and Finland. The partisan movement painstakingly built up throughout Europe. Stalin continued, would assume a vast scale and would paralyze the German army's supplies. By the end of the first year, Germany would have exhausted her limited stockpiles of scarce raw materials. Germany may be able to build aircraft and tanks, but she will lack the warriors themselves. Stalin emphasized, there is no such thing as an invincible army, whatever the country of its allegiance. A lavish banquet followed, with drinking far into the night. One of the generals, the director of the famous Frunz Military Academy, was toasting Stalin's genius for preserving peace of Europe. When Stalin irritably waved for him to stop, tottered to his feet, and delivered a second speech of his own. Another big quote here. During the years of the capitalist encirclement of the Soviet Union, we were able to make good use of the peace-loving slogan that we expanded the Soviet Union's frontiers while we expanded the Soviet Union's frontiers to the north and west. But now we must discard this slogan for the reactionary and narrow-minded slogan that it is, as it will not serve to win us one more square inch of territory. It is time to stop chewing that particular cud. Comrade Chosen, stop being a simpleton. The era of forcible expansion has begun for the Soviet Union. Raising his glass, Stalin announced a new and different toast. Long live the active policy of aggression of the Soviet nation. The end of that chapter.